You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Catherine M. Valente is the New York Times bestselling author of more than 24 works of fiction and poetry, including The Refrigerator Monologues, Palimpsest, Deathless, Radiance, and the crowdfunded phenomena of the girl who circumnavigated fairyland in a ship of her own making, and the novel Space Opera. She's the winner of the Andre Norton James Tiptree Jr. Memorial, My the Poets, Theodore Sturgeon Memorial, Lambda, Locus, and Hugo Awards, and has been a finalist for the Nebula and the World Fantasy Awards. Her new novel is a sequel to Space Opera. It's called Space Oddity. Thank you for joining me, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
I have to ask, over all these years, you've written so many wonderful books, and each... all of them are distinguished by amazing writing, prose writing, and sentences. You've written across a variety of genres. Talk about that. You seem to have focused on genres that include elements of fantastic, whether it's science fiction or fantasy. Why did you bring that amazing facility for language to genre fiction?
Well, I mean, I am what I am, and I grew up with genre fiction, and I love genre fiction. I always have. But, like, the odd thing is that when my first novel came out, which is called The Labyrinth, and it's, you know, long out of print except in a omnibus edition, but I didn't understand really that I was writing genre fiction at all. I was a classicist by academic training, and in classics, in ancient Greek and Roman culture, like a story involving like witches and curses and crazy technology and all that sort of thing that we think of as genre is just your average Tuesday in classics. That's just part of literature. And so it actually, I came out of such a intense academic whirlwind that like it never occurred to me that I wasn't writing literary fiction to begin with. And then it was, you know, patiently explained to me by a number of people, including agents and editors, that yes, in fact, this is very genre fiction. And then it seemed obvious. I'm not, you know, an idiot, but like those things are so much a part of how I interpret the world and my life and the sort of friendly ghosts of my existence are all folkloric and literary in terms of science fiction and fantasy and horror also. Like a few people remember that I was a horror writer first. It was my first genre love as a reader, and it was sort of the first subgenre that really embraced my work. So essentially, I'm not really interested in the real world. I mean, I am interested in the real world, and I write nonfiction about the real world, but the real world sucks in a very unmanageable way. Fiction can suck in a manageable way that, like, I can fix it. I can't really fix anything in the real world, but, like, I can create problems that I can fix and hope that that helps in some way the real world to be bearable. And I feel that genre fiction allows that kind of alchemy in a way that literary fiction or mimetic fiction that tries to faithfully duplicate the real world can't quite. Like genre fiction kicks you in the side of the head and it's already made you think about things differently. So when the real message kicks in, your defenses are kind of down. And there is this way that genre fiction can elevate and warn and illuminate and frighten and educate in a way that literary fiction, I think, doesn't quite have the full tool set to do.
And make us laugh.
Make us laugh, yeah. Well, literary fiction can make us laugh, fine. But I do think science fiction comedy is such a beast all its own, or indeed fantasy comedy, which has started to become more of a thing these days, and not just the kingdom over which Pratchett rules. But yeah.
By the solemn duty, I am allowed to crown you the queen of the American sentence. I have not read so many amazing sentences. And what struck me was that the second I started reading Space Opera and then followed it right up with Space Oddity, where your sentences are just hilarious and wonderful and insightful, I thought, this is the same woman who used that same sentence technique on amazing fantasy and amazing horror, where, you know, she just got right to your heart. Talk about your embrace of the sentence as a storytelling tool. I mean, it's like you wield diamonds or something.
Oh, thank you so much. It's such lovely things to say. I mean, many have pointed out that my sentences get quite long in space opera. And I will say that when I wrote space opera in 2017, I was coming off of about 5 years solid of writing middle grade fiction. So I might have gotten a little excited about being allowed to have sub clauses. But like, as you point out, I have been writing like this for some time. It's just the vocabulary that's changed. And I care a lot about language and how things sound. I started out as a poet. In a poem, there's really nowhere to hide. Every line has to count. Every word needs to be pulling double duty. And if you're writing shorter poems, there really is everything in it needs to be working toward the end goal of that poem. There can't be anything really extraneous that's there for flavor or no reason. The way you can do, and some of the things in fiction that are there for flavor and no reason are the best things. But when I was very young and starting out writing fiction, I just had this idea that every sentence could count in a book the way it does in a poem. And I cared about that very much. I still do care about that. I'm just tired now. So sometimes I allow myself throwaway lines now. But I'm a linguist by training. I'm a poet by training. I care deeply how things sound. I read my own work aloud as an editing tool. And I find that very valuable. I think when I was young, I just wanted to make pretty things that devastated people. Like that was the sort of the mission statement. I wanted to be very pretty and cut you in pieces.
My recall of reading those books was that was precisely the effect you achieved. And you know, one of the things that when Space Opera came out, one of the things that kind of surprised me was that immediately was, as I understood it, was an option for to become a movie or rumored to become a movie. And as I read it, I thought, well, the best parts of your fiction are it's writing. You invoke the power of the word and the actual reading experience to do things that simply could not be done in a movie.
Yeah, it was optioned. I think COVID killed that project. It was really looked like it was going to happen. It is under a different option now, in development as an animated series at Fox, which honestly, I have to say, I was a little hesitant before I met with the people involved, but they're fantastic. And in some ways, animation will allow some things that would have had to be cut out of a feature film and a live action film, purely in terms of money. Like you can't animate, like you can't CG all those aliens for free. But in animation, whether it's a human or an alien, it costs the same amount. And so I think that they, if that goes forward, they will be able to incorporate a lot of what I do. I've had many, many options. I've never had anything make it to the screen. So I can't say if the screen will be able to capture everything. And of course it won't capture everything that is in a book. It never can. But I am a very visual person. I've always said that if I could draw worth a damn, I never would have written, but I can't at all. I see things so vividly in my mind. And the only way I can sort of make them real is to use words, because that's what I'm good at. I also love film. I grew up in a house that was very devoted to film and filmmaking through my father. And I would love to see anything of mine on film. I will say that, like, when it was going to be a feature film, I wasn't very involved in the sort of planning stages of that. But nobody likes a voiceover unless it's a perfect voiceover. And I'm not totally sure how you would do space opera without a voiceover, because I think that a lot of those little interstitial, for anybody listening who has read either of these books, like, those little interstitial bits that both serve as exposition and as, you know, little hints of what's to come, They're based on Eurovision itself, which before every act has what are called postcards, and it'll be like a little shot of the band and trivia about the country and their history in Eurovision and everything. So like it comes from the structure of Eurovision itself. But how do you do those on film without having just somebody say those things? But it wasn't my job to write that script, and I think in a series we would have a lot more space and time to illuminate those in like bottle episodes and things like that. So I really do hope that goes forward. I think that's probably the right format for this particular story.
Well, for me, I just enjoy the reading of your work. It's so powerfully well written, no matter what genre you write in. And I have to ask, what took you, made you decide to, what, back 2015 or so, decide to channel your inner British bureaucrat?
Honestly, it's the dumbest story of how a book got made ever, or most brilliant. I don't know. The two books of mine that have done the best, the two bestsellers, have been ones that I more or less wrote out of the blue, one on a dare, one because I couldn't make rent, and like never intended those to be books. The ones that I spend 5 years pouring my soul into, not so much. But I was live tweeting Eurovision, which is a thing that I adore. Fell in love with it in 2012, and I live tweeted it every year. So this was May 2016, which is going to be a relevant date in a minute. But I was live tweeting Eurovision, and a fan, I will always credit him forever. I owe so much to Charles Tan. Charles Tan, a fan in the Philippines, tweeted at me, "You love this so much. You should write a science fiction or fantasy Eurovision." And I wrote back, "Ha, that'd be cool." And 5 minutes later, I got a DM from an editor at Simon and Schuster saying, "I'll buy that right now." And that, I mean, that never happens. It really doesn't. And my agent calls it the fastest deal in publishing. It was supposed to be a novella. It became clear pretty quickly that I had bitten off much more than I could chew. I didn't have any ideas for it at all when I signed the contract. It literally says Eurovision in space on the original contract. I didn't have a title, I didn't have a protagonist, I had nothing. I just had faith that it would come. So in the planning phases of it, I knew that, now mind you, this is mid-2016, so the election hasn't happened yet. I knew I wanted the band to be British for a couple of reasons. One is that I've lived there, so I felt like I didn't have to do all the research in the universe, and I could, it wasn't totally appropriative because I have a lot of experience with that culture. And also, I thought it would be funny because up until very recently, England didn't do very well at Eurovision, pretty notoriously. It's kind of a running joke, nil point, that Britain gets no points. They did fine in the up until the 90s, and then have it's been kind of a running joke ever since. Now, fortunately, unfortunately, I don't know, but in 2022, Britain came in second with a song called Spaceman because the universe wants me to be happy. And Ukraine could not host for obvious reasons. And so the UK ended up hosting Eurovision. So that's the problem with writing near future science fiction. As soon as you write it, like it's completely changed. One of the music review venues in space opera that is quoted as having reviewed Decibel and the Absolute Zeros went out of business 5 weeks after the book came out. I was like, "Oh, guys, come on!" But yeah, so
That's a
I
great
ended
sentence in
up being
itself.
yeah, right. I wanted them to be British, but when I sat down and I wrote the first chapter of space opera in a fairly short amount of time. It really was ready to come out, I guess. About 45 minutes under that first chapter. And I sat back and I had to have a think because I looked at that and I was like, I like this. This might actually end up being one of the best things I've written. I really like doing this. I really like the rhythm. I really like what I can do here. But everyone's going to compare it to Douglas Adams. Am I prepared to be compared to Douglas Adams as a female American, goofy person? And am I prepared to be compared negatively to Douglas Adams? And I decided, yep, yeah. The thing is, that if you're going to write Brits in space, the comparison will happen. Doesn't matter, you know, how similar or not similar to Adams it is, the comparison will exist. John Scalzi once called Douglas Adams an extinction level event for science fiction comedy. And it's true. His shadow just was such a long one for such a long time. If you weren't going to be that good, you might as well not even try. But I found it freeing because I'm not going to be that good. Am I going to write the greatest science fiction comedy? Nope. Been done. Never going to happen. But I could shoot for the bronze, and that felt comfortable and comfortable to experiment. And what I felt that I could do with that British bureaucrat, dry, kind of ironic, winking sense of humor was just get like my gross American feelings all over it, and make it sort of hyper emotional, a little younger, a little gayer, a little more poppy, and, you know, a little updated, because I adore Adams to a degree I can barely express, but, you know, digital watch jokes don't pack quite the same punch. So I felt like I could add all of my drippy feelings to that kind of sense of humor.
One of the things that, as I read this, I have to say, I mean, you compare well to Adams. It's reminiscent, but I think that you have a more precise prose style that allows you to do some really interesting things. Satire is so often based on making fun of a single person or a single event or a single genre, blah, blah, blah. What you do is you use your incredible talent with sentences to pare things down and just tell jokes that within the sentence. You make fun, in a sense, of language itself. And it's such a joy to read. I mean, it's one of those books that's hard not to read aloud to your long-suffering partner or spouse. You say, oh, you got to hear this. Oh, my, really? Can't I just read the book instead? No, I've got to read it to you. So talk about how you approach this in terms of language. When you started out, when you wrote that first chapter, you set a good template for yourself. Did you know what you were doing, or did it just happen?
I'm not sure I did know what I was doing at first. I'd never written anything that was sort of comedy on the tin. Like, I'd written comedic scenes within a longer dramatic work, but I'd never written anything where like the top genre was comedy. I didn't know if I could be that consistently funny. I didn't know if I could hold up that tone for as many pages as I had ahead of me. I'm not sure I did. It was very by the seat of my pants, the first book. And really, like, it went through a lot of changes in the editing process. This is actually what I'm about to say is in the liner notes of Space Oddity. Space Oddity is dedicated to two people, and one of them is Christopher Priest, who passed not long ago. And I happened to be co-guest of honor with him at a convention in France while I was trying to edit Space Opera. And I had like a vicious crisis of confidence. I was like, I don't know, this might be just awful. I don't know if I just screwed up something that I really thought was going to be good in the beginning, or if maybe I should just give up. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. And he really, like, halftime coach pep talked me through all of it. Like, he took me under his wing. It was exactly what I needed to hear at the time, even though, like, he hadn't read my work. He introduced himself the way many, this is not meant to be a dig on anyone who has introduced themselves to me this way, but many men introduce themselves to me by saying, my girlfriend loves your work. That's fine. I've thought about making t-shirts, your girlfriend loves my work, but he had not read my work, but that didn't matter, because the message of, like, you actually have to be the one that believes in yourself before anyone else can, and all those things just apply no matter what your work is. And he really helped me to get past that, because I don't think I really did know what I was doing with space opera, because you can only really look at Adams so much. I think that one of the things that makes space opera very different is that Adams perspective on the world is very cynical, and I mean hilariously so, and quite appropriately Britishly so for the era in which he was writing. It is so perfectly situated in the era it was created. And space opera, as I was saying, the 2016 thing was going to come in and be important because I sold it and started planning it before the election, but didn't start writing it until January 2017. And the election had happened, and I didn't even know if I could make a joke anymore. I found everything just impossible to laugh at. And actually, I'm a year off, but anyway, it doesn't matter. The Eurovision itself has this sort of dark thing, and I ended up doing this dark kind of core with space opera. But space opera is a book about hope. It really is. And Adams is after totally different fish. So, you know, to make those kind of complex, cynical jokes while you are arcing towards a general message of hope and solidarity is pretty tough. And I'm not sure I knew if I could pull that off until the reviews started coming in. And everybody has compared it to Adams, and I'm completely fine with that. And people have been so kind and lovely. And to, for, again, an American person who is a huge fan of his, like to be spoken of in the same sentence is beyond an honor. But I do think my favorite review, as you say, about reading out loud, is that somebody DM'd me to say, I need you to understand I'm at a parade in my hometown and there are two teenagers talking to each other and one is reading space opera to the other. That's my favorite review, because that's what we all did with Hitchhiker's Guide. Just as you say, you got to hear this part. Let me read you this part. We all did that. And that two teens were doing that with my book, that's all I needed.
Douglas Adams is only one of two names that hang over both of these books. The other is of the late David Bowie. What an amazing man. And you know, it's interesting, I was thinking about this, that this book took me back to my own adolescence, which still continues to this day, much to my own regret usually, because at the same time I first discovered like literary satire. The first, I was a big fan of Mad Magazine, as many kids were back when I was a kid. And then I discovered Philip Roth's Our Gang, which was not reviewed as his best book, but when you're 15 and that thing comes out, it's an amazing piece of discovery. And at about the same time, I discovered this British chap making music I really liked, David Bowie.
Yep.
So yeah. Talk about the influence of Bowie on your writing and in this book, these
Good
books.
Lord. I'm not sure that I recall any kind of sentience in my own life where I didn't know who David Bowie was. My dad's a big Bowie fan. I remember my stepmother showing me the concert video of the Spiders from Mars, like the concert movie, and like talking to me about what a concept album was, and like that, like this is a story too, and music can be, I was very young, like music can be stories. And his fashion, she loved his fashion. And I remember her saying, like, is he dressed as a girl? Is he dressed as a boy? And I was like, mm. And she was like, isn't that cool that you can't really tell? Like, isn't that amazing? And I loved him. And then Labyrinth came out, which was one of my favorite movies. And I just grew up mired in Bowie, I guess. And yeah, he's a big part of space opera and space oddity, obviously. I was a little like, is the lightning bolt too on the nose when we first came back with the cover design? But actually, when people get a chance to read the book, it's very appropriate. Weather is a kind of an antagonist in Space Oddity in a weird way, or at least it's a major plot point. So yeah, like there's no escaping Bowie. And Decibel Jones is D. Jones. David Jones is Bowie's, you know, real name. There's a lot of references in there, not just to him, but to a lot of glam rock and classic rock kind of champions and Freddie Mercury and things like that. But I think that we have rarely seen an artist like Bowie who who wasn't just a musician. Every aspect of his aesthetic was extremely curated and changed, evolved. I mean, maybe somebody like Lady Gaga is a comparable example. I don't like her music as much, but like she has her sort of house of fashion and all of that. But, you know, Bowie had his own ISP before people knew what an ISP was. He was an incredibly far-seeing person. He may not have been a novelist, but he was a science fictionist, as far as I'm concerned. Much of his music is, and he saw the future very clearly in a way a lot of people didn't really get when he was trying to explain to people what an ISP is. And I just think icon doesn't cut it when you're talking about Bowie.
In your first novel, in space opera, humanity encounters aliens, and I think it's one of the best first contact novels ever written, because our, you know, science fiction's visions of first contact has been pretty much, you know, like, well, they all look pretty much like us, and they drive rocket ships like us, and they probably have checkbooks like us, and economics like us, and blah, blah, blah. And the sheer insanity of your aliens and the variety reminds me, the only writer I think who has come close to you, a Polish writer, Stanisław Lem.
Oh my God. Good Lord. Another person that, like, just to be spoken of in the same sentence, God, Lem is an absolute total genius. And whoever translated his works into English, like
Michael Kandel.
Yeah.
Boy, amazing stuff.
To be able to bring puns like that between languages, my God, like, I am such a fan of Lem. He's incredible. There's a lot of aliens and they're all very alien, but that was part of my own mission statement for myself, that they couldn't be Star Trek aliens. They couldn't just have a funny forehead. Each of these had to be completely distinct as the countries in Europe that participate in Eurovision are. They had to be distinct, they had to be unique, and they had to have some kind of grounded anatomy. And the reason they had to have that anatomy was because I had to invent a music tradition for each of these species. And music comes from our bodies. It comes from anatomy. It comes from the beat of our heart. The beats that sound natural to us come from the natural world that we evolved in, and they come from the rhythms of our own bodies. You know, our 10 fingers determine what kinds of music we will be playing, what kind of scales, what kind of math is involved. The shape of our ears and the infrasonic range that we experience, like, this determines what we like in music. So any alien species would be the same. Their anatomy would determine what they liked in music. So that was where each of their kind of musical traditions started, was with the anatomy of these aliens. And so there's about 40 species. They are all wildly disparate, and they all have pretty crazy ways of making music. I just really felt that if I was going to have like a contest of cultures the way Eurovision is, then I got to have cultures to contest. And I wanted to make them very real. One of the things I liked about writing this series is not just the chance to write about Eurovision, but to satirize a lot of tropes of science fiction. So, you know, the sort of predator species, the Yurtmak, and their particular very, you know, death-centric culture, like, came from, even as a kid, I was pretty bored by predators. I'm like, how did they even invent space travel? Like, when all they do are these slavering, kind of drippy, roaring monsters. And of course, later on in the series, we get some lore on them, but that's never been the point of the predator. So, like, I made the greatest philosopher in the galaxy be one of the geeks of this species. And I was able to do things like that and poke fun at some of the tropes of first contact and of science fiction that had sort of always irritated me, which I also did in Fairyland. Fairyland does that with children's literature. And so I found it very satisfying to be able to do that. And I do think that First contact is unlikely to be anything like we imagine. Particularly, there's a whole scene in space opera where the alien representative talks about how disturbing they find our film tradition because it's all about how terrible aliens are. And in fact, we are the terrifying space monsters to them. And I like playing with perspective that way. And I like playing with, what we used to call the great conversation. And I haven't heard that phrase in a long time, but like playing with where my work sits in a science fictional tradition.
One of the things that I found so entertaining about these books was the Eurovision vision of it. So talk about, the setup of the contest and the genres of music that you create for each of these things, they are hilarious. I mean,
Well, I'm
you
glad
must love
more.
music and quite
I
a bit.
do. I love music. I do very much love music. And I love pop music. And I love not just pop music itself, but the whole history of it and the stories of, I was a behind the music watcher from way back. But the whole kind of folkloric tradition of pop music is a wonderful thing. And I Eurovision itself. I feel like I have become like this annoying door-to-door evangelist for Eurovision. Like, have you heard the good news? Eurovision is here to bless us and raise us up. Because most Americans, when the first book came out, didn't know what Eurovision was. Will Ferrell did me a real solid by making a Eurovision movie, so now it's a little bit easier, and Americans have started to watch it a lot more. But it's a As far as the folkloric cycle of pop music, Eurovision is such an incredible example of it. It's been going since 1956, every year except 2020. It was created to bring the continent back together after they'd spent the first part of the 20th century bombing each other into the Stone Age. And I think that that is genuinely one of the most beautiful things humanity's ever done. Like, let's sing it out next time. And they have sung it out for quite some time. Eurovision. If you're not aware of the history of it, it's hard to explain how much Eurovision has braided together with actual European political history. It's quippy but true. I often describe it as like Miss Universe meets The Voice meets World War I, because the simple rule of you can't vote for your own country means that the scoreboard of any given Eurovision is a snapshot of European political theater at the time. And terrible and astonishing things have happened during Eurovision. There's a Portuguese revolution in 1979 where the singer adjusting the rose on his lapel was the symbol to storm the Capitol steps. Their votes have been given out while missiles went overhead. Bosnia and Herzegovina came in the 90s in the midst of the genocide with a song called All the Pain in the World. This has been a place where statements have been made and where it is safe to do that for its entire existence. And I love the fact that that is all there. And so is the most absurd dancing and music and costumes you've ever seen in your life. Just absolutely bonkers stuff. There's a guy in a like glitter butcher's apron singing this Trumpet makes you my girl. That's an actual line from a Moldovan song from 2012, I think. And just like absolutely ridiculous songs, and then songs that like break your heart open, songs that are genuinely some of my favorite songs. So the goofiness and the seriousness being side by side is not only sort of the nougat at the core of Eurovision, but it is like what I love best in my own work. I love having these fantastical, out of this world things, even goofy things, even highly sentimental things, unforgivably sentimental, some might say, right next to things that are so serious that like you have to sit down to read it. That kind of thing is, I don't like using the word brand. That kind of thing is just my aesthetic. It's my thing.
One of the things that I found really amazing about this book was, I mean, while it makes me laugh out loud many times per page, often, too, I would find it kind of heartbreaking and touching and sweet and wonderful. And I think that that's what makes these books really, both of them, really solid. We really come to care about these completely bonkers characters and even the weirdest, wildest, most dripping aliens that you have to show moments of true caring and understanding. Talk about embedding your comedy with sweetness and joy and happiness, and I obviously hope.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so there's a good example that popped into my head when you said that. It's in Space Opera. There's now I have to remember the names of all my species. It's the flower one. The ones on Lutost is their home planet. Oh, it's Claveret. I was like, it's Danish for piano. All of the names of the alien species and their planets and anything in their culture and their personal names, they all come from the languages of countries that have participated in Eurovision, any country that has, which is the smartest thing I ever did. It's the only thing that allowed me to come up with all of those terms that fast. And it is just chock full of Easter eggs because of that. And most people don't put it all together. They speak another language or two and they recognize those, but don't realize that they're all from all these other languages. So Claveret, it's Danish for piano. The Claveret are a botanical species. They are kind of rose brambles and they are kind of aggressively optimistic. And there's a kind of throwaway line. And that's often how I do it. The throwaway lines often have the sweetness or the knife, depending on what's needed. But that their most popular sitcom is called Everyone Gets Enough Love. And like that joke is obviously like everyone hates Raymond or everyone loves Raymond. Ha ha. Freudian slip. But I wanted a quick joke about a sitcom. And I was just like, well, what's actually going on in any given sitcom? No one's getting enough love, so everything's terrible. And so like just that one throwaway joke kind of illuminates an entire culture, an alien, but more positive, not less, view of comedy, of culture, of like what the goal should be. And, you know, reminds us how often that doesn't happen in our own lives. And so like poetry, like we were talking about, it's a line, it's a joke that does like quadruple duty. And I'm always kind of looking for that to layer in sweetness with the sour, sour with the sweetness. And I don't know, I think that's probably who I am as a person. I'm kind of abrasive and I have a foul mouth and I swear too much and I'm, you know, grumpy all the time, but like, I'm very sweet when you cut through all that thorny exterior. And I don't know, I think you can't devastate too much without people just being depressed, and you can't give them too much sweetness or it feels insincere and saccharine. And I think that I grew up in the 90s and early 2000s, came of age in the 90s and early 2000s where irony was king. And I remember reading this essay by David Foster Wallace called E Unibus Pluram, and it's about the development of televisual entertainment. And he is in the very early 90s talking about irony and why irony is a thing. And he predicts that, he's like, I don't know how that's gonna work out. Maybe the next generation will practice radical sincerity as a reaction against. And I was like, that's it, buddy. That's what we have done. And I think my generation of writers in many ways leans hard on that radical sincerity, and I lean on it till it breaks. But like radical accessible sincerity, we feel it for you wholesale. Is kind of where I have found a place that my self expression gets a good shape from the mold.
One of the aspects of Adam's work, and in fact, it's right in the title, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, is that a faux book plays a big part in it. And you also have a faux book in both of these things. And let's see, Grognar Gore Cannon.
I talked about this at the live reading the other night because someone asked what goguenard means. And I was like, oh, I don't remember. It's French. And someone quickly looked it up and it means mocking in French. But yeah, goguenard gore canon is that Yurtmak murder hippo is sort of the nickname for the species. Predator like great philosopher. She has a very foul mouth, but is sweet at heart. And it's her goguenard gore canon's unkillable facts is the like most popular children's book in the galaxy. I mean, I love doing a book within a book. That's what Fairyland was, but I knew it couldn't be anything approaching like a travel guide or anything like that. Like I was already skating way too close to the sun with everything else in the book. And it's funny because I didn't have a child when I wrote the first one and I do now. But I just wanted to be able to say true things in an authoritative way. If there's a book within a book, that book is an authority to people within, you know, that fictional world. And so I could make aphorisms about the universe, like life is beautiful and life is stupid, and give them a gloss of authority within my own fictional construct. And I just loved the idea of this sad predator, like in her little hut, like trying to be a scientist and trying to, you know, find love on their terrifying dating apps and like writing down all these very cynical, very hurt. She's a very hurt person. All of these very cynical rules for life that are very true, at least from, you know, the perspective of an interstellar civilization in the Milky Way galaxy. And I love doing Gore Cannon's facts. And in this one, there is another. I'm not going to be able to remember the exact title exactly, which is why I write things down, so I don't have to. It's something like goguenard Gore Cannon's unkillable addendums for you dumb puddings who didn't listen to me the first time. So it's addendums to each of the previous facts, sort of illuminating post-publication problems, I think really is where it's at, that people took her advice the wrong way and she wants to correct it. It's one of my favorite parts of the book. I would love one day to like make just a little volume that, you know,
I was wondering,
could actually read.
Call up Subterranean Press and tell them.
But yeah, no, there's definitely, and there's of course, there's all kinds of music and movies and television and books within the space opera universe. So there's a lot of that, but certainly Gore Cannon is the one that sort of hovers over everybody's psyche.
I'd like you to talk about one of the things that these books do so well is that while they're being hilarious and funny and insightful and sweet and charming, they also have good plots and great characters that you can grok really well. And we enjoy it. One of the things about a book is that when I'm reading that book, do I want to be with this character or that character? If there's a character I like less, then, you know, okay, I'll read through this part and then we'll get to the scenes I like. But with yours, it's universal. We like every bit, every person, even though they're all wildly different, we like them all the same. Talk about the challenges of embedding, you know, a satire of language and current culture, embedding that with great characters and a good plot.
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly difficult. It's writing a novel has a lot of plates spinning at once, and you have to keep them spinning for quite a long time. I think that the language kind of helps because part of what makes us like people is the way that they talk, the way that they phrase things. That's the only way we get information from them is by listening to them speak, and the way that people phrase their thoughts is part of what endears them to us. So, you know, by giving characters very distinct voices and ways of speaking, it's easy to make somebody like them. I teach this in my classes, but the easiest way to get somebody to like a character is to hurt them in front of the audience, because the audience feels protective and doesn't want bad things to happen to that character. And that goes for villains as well. The thing is, I have to spend more time with these people than any reader ever will. I've just spent months and months with these people, and I don't want to spend time with anyone that I don't like on some level, nor do I think I could write a villain that I like was completely incomprehensible, like completely unredeemable. There's not even, one sort of core of goodness. To me, what makes a good villain is the tragedy of somebody who couldn't put it together. That there is some kind of hurt or flaw in them that they're always trying to heal and they never can. That's why they become villains. The very worst psychological disorders that we're aware of in humanity, they all come from a childhood hurt. There is a kid in pain inside the worst people. And I don't know, writing a book right after the election, there might have been a hurt child in charge of my country that I had to think about every day and spend time with their nonsense every day, in a way I really didn't enjoy at all. But the antagonist of Space Oddity is named Mr. Snuggles, and in many ways, his whole deal comes from everything I've been watching happen for the last 8 years, of proto-fascists or aspiring fascists, not being necessarily smart, but just willing to break things, and willing to not care about the way things are set up or done, and just barge through it and say a very destabilizing thing, which is mentioned in Space Oddity, that what if we just didn't do that? What if we just, didn't sublimate all of our warfare into a musical contest instead, even though that's kept the peace for 100 years? What if we just had a whole bunch of acting secretaries instead of going through the senatorial process? What if we just cheated at an election? What if we just got in bed with foreign powers that aren't terribly interested in anything but maintaining their power? What if we just launch a land invasion of a country, when everybody else is trying real hard to stop doing that? What if we just screw everything up is the central question at the core of a lot of very chaotic forces in politics. And that's kind of where Mr. Snuggles is at. He just does not care. He just wants to break things so he can be in charge of the pieces, which is not any kind of unique observation of mine, but I do think that we're seeing a pretty unique expression of that kind of impulse towards chaos. And while it's, again, this is like a problem I can fix within my own book, I cannot fix this problem in the real world. But it is a problem of hurt children. It's a bunch of people who didn't get hugged enough. It's a whole bunch of people who never were properly socialized. They're like feral cats who were never socialized with other kittens. And these feral cats have been put in charge of levers of our system. And in being forced to try to understand that, to push against it, you get pretty good at imagining the way a villain who wants to rule the galaxy thinks.
One of the things that I think that makes your books so successful is the ability to make us laugh about things in a manner that allows us to take them in, I think, better. It's the idea of externalizing all these things that we don't like to talk about. We don't, the 10,000th time you've heard somebody call somebody a fascist or say, oh, you're trying to do this or whatever, So talk about using fiction, and this applies to your fantasy fiction as well, to externalize and discuss those aspects of our lives that do not do well when discussed directly, like in person. You can't argue with some of these people. It's just not worth it.
Well, I mean, I think this kind of goes back to something we were talking about at the beginning about what genre fiction can do, the tricks that it can do, that literary fiction it's absolutely can do, but is harder to pull off. And I think you're right, like words like fascism and fascist and all of that sort of thing, like we get used to them. they become noise, and they've been repeated so many times, and the real fear of them is gone, and it doesn't hit you anymore. So writing something that is writ so large, be that fantasy or science fiction, allows you to use different words for the same thing in a way that will get behind people's defenses and inability to, give an inch, even if a mile is necessary. And I think that that is one of the absolute golden tools in the toolbox of genre fiction. There's an amazing tradition in Russian literature of political dissent within fantasy and science fictional works. The Strugatsky brothers particularly, but
Oh yeah, I love those guys. They are so good.
yeah, they're wonderful. And Master and Margarita,
Right,
and
right. Bulgakov.
Bulgakov, yeah. And indeed, several other, Via Kaverin and Gogol, there's many of them, because you could not criticize the government in mimetic fiction, because that was about the real world and you were criticizing the government. But if Baba Yaga is doing something bad, that's just a fairy tale. And since genre fiction wasn't taken very seriously, that is where a lot of dissent was. And so I am not the only person that realizes, this great magic trick that genre fiction can do. It can really get to places that are deep in the territory of people who have defenses against it. And that includes me as well. It includes anyone. We all have blind spots, and we all have things that we were raised to believe that aren't necessarily factual. We all have, things to work through. There's really no such thing as, like you mentioned, like the adolescence that never ends. It was always the great lie that adolescence ends at all. It never does. There's no such thing as coming of age. There's only coming of an age. And Decibel is like 50, and both books are coming of ages for him. But that's real life. We come of age all the time, and we learn and we grow. And part of the way that we learn and grow is by developing the empathy to understand and sympathize and care for characters that are nothing like us, that are radically unlike us. And by reading these stories that know how to get under our skin, where words that have been repeated 1,000 times just kind of bounce off.
Do you know which way you're going to turn next? Literally?
I'm writing a book called Nobody But Us right now, which is a near future gender dystopia slash utopia, depending on how you look at it. That was inspired actually by the Strugatsky brothers, believe it or not.
Which book?
Roadside Picnic.
Oh,
Amongst
one of my
everything,
favorite.
fiction writer, was really inspired by Roadside Picnic. But I'm such a massive fan of the Strugatskys. I think that they should be far more well known in the West than they are.
What did
And
you
they're
think of
well
The Stalker?
Oh my God. I mean, right? Like
I
it's that's one, but that's one of those great examples of what I was talking about, because a lot of the terminology in The Stalker and in Roadside Picnic become part of the real world when Chernobyl happens.
Oh,
Like
yeah.
the phrase exclusion zone, that was not a phrase until Roadside Picnic. Like the stalkers, like the Russian words for those people in that story, is what the workers that were going into Chernobyl to clear things out were called. It became part of the real world. And part of the reason for that was that it stuck in your head so much, because those weren't the phrases we were using euphemistically for the rest, for workers that are definitely going to die because this is an authoritarian regime. Well, you can say that all day long, and it's very academic. But the stalkers going in and out in the exclusion zone and all of that, it just gets to this deep folkloric hindbrain. The constant grape shot of everyday news and discourse, it just can't do.
The new novel by Catherine Valente is Space Oddity. It's a sequel to Space Opera. Thank you for joining me, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.